Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me tonight, we have two co-hosts from the Predictacast podcast. We have Josh and Brian.
Hello.
Hey, John, how are you doing today?
Good. Do you want to tell everyone about where they can listen to your stuff and what other stuff you've done?
Sure, yeah. So we host Predictocast, which is basically a podcast where we watch the first 10 minutes of a movie that we don't know anything about, and then we try to predict what happens in the rest of the movie. You can find us wherever you get podcasts or at predictocast.com. It's a lot of fun. Come over and check us out. We have a good time, and we're mostly always wrong about what happens in the movies.
And two people who sound an awful lot like you used to have a podcast called Butterfly Kisses that I'd like to put a plug in for.
I heard it's a podcast where two people break down the hit song Butterfly by Crazy Town line by line. But who would ever want to do that? That seems like a stupid idea.
Okay, so this time we are doing Nathaniel West's 1939 novel Day of the Locust. Had either of you heard of this book before I suggested it?
No, I had not.
I had, but I had not read it before.
I feel like I need to apologize to both of you, because as I was saying before we started this podcast, this was a book I read in grad school for my comprehensive examinations. It must have been around 1994, and I completely forgot everything that happened in this book, other than remembering that it was a satire on Hollywood during the 1930s, and it was about people coming from the middle of America and going and living in Hollywood. And I thought, hey, that sounds like Josh.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, I was not middle America, but I was born in Mississippi and lived a bunch of places. And then now I currently live in California, in Burbank, which is basically a suburb outside of L.A., really close to Hollywood. I was in Hollywood last night for something. So like it was very interesting when you brought this book up to me as one that I could possibly come onto the show to discuss, because I'd never heard of it. But then when I started looking into it, I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. I'm actually, through my job, about to join the Art Directors Guild. So like I'll be a guild member and like contributing things to television and movie productions and stuff. So it's like, oh, this kind of lines up with me, except it doesn't quite go like the experience that I've had since living in California.
And Brian, I apologize. I couldn't come up with anything having to do with Minnesota.
Well, I think to a degree, like I thought of it while reading it, like, you know, Sinclair Lewis, like Main Street, did a lot of satire in the early part of the century about like Main Street and the Midwest where I live and everything. This is more a Hollywood take on that, skewering them instead of, you know, a little bit more a bunch of guys lusting after a 17-year-old.
Yeah. Right. This book is typically called a black comedy. You know, I actually do remember Nathaniel West's other novel, which is a much shorter novel called Miss Lonely Hearts. Miss Lonely Hearts is a book about the newspaper business in the 1930s. Day of the Locust is about the movie business in the 1930s. Miss Lonely Hearts is, I think, a little lighter, as light as a story can be, where everyone dies at the end. But but it's a little more, I think I'd be more comfortable calling that a comedy. I had remembered this being funny. I thought, oh, that'd be great. Well, give it to these guys because it'll be a nice light read. And no, it's a pretty dark, depressing, highly cynical story, full of characters that you're not really supposed to like.
Yeah, that's definitely true. It is tough going through books like this where almost every character is someone that is just sort of despicable in some way or another. Like Homer is not really that despicable until the end when he starts stomping that child to death. But like, you know, Todd is our main sort of POV guy, is just the things that come out of his mouth and the things that he thinks, it can be really tough sometimes.
Brian, did you like anyone?
Like anyone. You know, Harry had a certain amount of, you could almost feel for him. He's just trying to cover a lot with his shtick, because that's all he knows and all he has. And sometimes in life, you feel like a little bit of an imposter, and you just kind of push that part of you that is an act forward and forward and forward. And then you sometimes feel trapped by it. But I don't think you do it to the point in real life that often where you're faking an illness and then realizing, oh shit, I'm actually dying. But it's funny because there's points where I won't forget that's a satire, because you're just following Todd, and Todd's kind of floating through this whole world, almost aimlessly just following Faye. But then like he goes to that party and there's a rubber horse in the pool. And you're like, oh, they're skewering Hollywood parties. It's supposed to be a black satire. We're supposed to laugh at this.
Now, do you think that rubber horse in the pool was where they got the idea for BoJack?
That's probably not far off. I wouldn't be surprised if they have some writer on the show, or someone, that creator has read this book at some point and remembered it subconsciously when he was working on BoJack.
Maybe they were like trying to, you know, bone up on stuff on cartoon history, and they looked up Homer Simpson and they got this book instead.
Right. Now, this is a good point. One of the main characters in this book is named Homer Simpson, which is very alarming for a modern reader to read through. This Homer Simpson, of course, predates the Homer Simpson we all know and love. And in interviews, Groening has said that he did name Homer Simpson both after his father, but also after the character in this book.
Well, because those characters have such similarities, like they're huge hands.
they're just both soft mannered, incredibly sexually repressed, just to the point where like your hands just, you just can't stop them, because they're just full of just manic energy that will just reach out at any possible chance of sexual output or even friend output. Like just having a connection to a person makes your hands just want to twitch, but you can't let that happen. Just like Homer Simpson and donuts.
Right. Now, I won't give too much of the plot away, but for anyone who hasn't read the book, this is basically the story of Todd Hackett, who is an artist from Yale, who has come to Hollywood to be a set designer. And he drifts through a world full of seedy characters, including bookies and prostitutes and people who are on the margins of the movie industry, people who want to break into the movie industry but can't, people who are ex-vaudeville performers. And it's a book full of you know, just trashy parties and lust and attempted rape and
there, especially towards the end, there's that moment where Todd is eating a steak and he is imagining like this scenario where he finds Faye and he has like a bottle in his hand and he's just imagining smashing her over the head and assaulting her. And it was just like, whoa, this is our main character.
And he's doing it in a way, it's like, I'm trying to bring power to thought. Like this is my escape for the day. I'm just going to go to my thought palace where I rape the main female character in the book.
Right. Now, Todd is an interesting character because typically in a story like this, you expect the touchstone character to be the outsider who's going to provide some sort of viewpoint through which we can see how crazy Hollywood is. But Todd is just as crazy as anyone else, and he seems highly disassociated. All through the book, he is fantasizing about this major painting he's going to paint called The Burning of Los Angeles. This is this apocalyptic scene of the destruction of the city. When you start reading this book, you kind of feel like maybe he's supposed to be the Jeremiah character who's going to tell truth to Hollywood's weird power. But he's just as damaged as anyone in this book, and probably more than most.
When he introduces the thought of the whole concept of the burning of Los Angeles, and he's talking about the people with the mean eyes that he hasn't gotten to know quite well yet, but he sees them staring at the Hollywood scene, the success stories, and they're just in California and they're angry. And it feels like here's this outsider who is going to reject the Hollywood insiders, the Hollywood elite, and learn these people, and he'll paint their story in this painting. That's not what happens. He just becomes more of the people who are going to get burned.
In the very first chapter, when we go through a sort of a physical description of him, the narrative voice comes and says, despite his appearance, he was really a very complicated young man with a whole set of personalities, one inside the other, like a nest of Chinese boxes. This is remarkable to me for two reasons. One, that it's strange to have the narrator tell us this. You know, this is kind of a tell, don't show moment very early on in the book, coming from the narrative voice, no less. And then nothing else that happens in this book leads you to believe that this statement is true.
It really feels like Todd's telling you this, but he's not the narrator as far as we can tell.
Yeah, it's kind of the same way that they keep referring to the burning of Los Angeles as like a masterpiece. Like it's sort of like an internal narrator or an internal monologue in Todd's head where he keeps telling himself this thing is going to be a masterpiece. It's going to be this incredibly important work. It doesn't feel like it's a narrator saying, oh, in the future, this has become an important work and here's how it sort of came to be. It's like he has convinced himself that this work that he's doing is important for some reason.
Well, he almost like has to consider like it is an important work, because otherwise he's doing a job he seems completely disconnected from. And every action he takes in the movie is just to be within the sphere of presence of Faye. Like nothing else he does has any passion to it. He just wants to be near Faye and sleep with her just once, maybe. When I was reading up some notes on it afterwards, and I just finished it, and I was like, okay, I want to kind of compare notes on the internet with my own thoughts, as I often do, just to get reaffirmed or kicked in the pants. But I had totally forgotten by the end of the book that Faye was only supposed to be 17, and it was such a gut punch. Like, the whole cockfighting thing between the male characters near the end, even grosser to me in 2019.
Faye is a bit part player, an extra in a lot of Hollywood movies, who lives in the same building as Todd, and whom Todd desperately wants to have sex with, as you say, at least once. Todd gets really excited at one point when he is led to believe that she might be a prostitute in the employ of this madam he meets. And he asks the madam if Faye is possibly a client, because he thinks, oh, this will be the way that I'll get her to sleep with me.
And then he kind of misses his chance with that later, because he's not around when she is.
Yeah, when she has to do that to pay for her dad's funeral, which is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a book full of again, you know, the scenes of Hollywood. The scenes of Hollywood are interesting to me because they seem like anyone who's seen, say, the movie Ed Wood. And at the beginning, when we have Ed Wood character walking through the Hollywood lots and moving from one surreal scene to the other, one large historical epic to the next. Or if you see a Coen Brothers film like Hail Caesar.
Yeah.
you see how people are drawing on this vision of Hollywood as this surreal dream state. You're walking in and out of history, but nobody seems to care that much about it.
Yeah, and it sort of seems like he views it all as like pure artifice, because later when he sees Faye and he realizes that she's must be an extra in this movie they're filming, he kind of goes through the entire lot and he goes through all these different places, and then he comes across that big like dumping ground for all these old pieces of the sets from various films, and it's just sort of him looking at this dream dump, I think is what he calls it, of all of these fake things that are just being thrown there and kind of left there to disintegrate and rot away.
So Josh, when you like make a wallpaper for a TV show, do you ever worry about where it ends up after filming? Like your poor wallpaper just sitting in a bin in a back lot somewhere and have nailed it?
Nope. I'm pretty sure that it's just gonna go in the trash. I mean, that's
not to crap on your work or anything, but have you ever given thought to like the long-term of your dreams made paper?
No, I actually did have to confront this though, because I did do I did design a lot of the wallpaper for the holiday season of the Netflix show Nailed It, and then I saw that they were coming back with another like special themed season, and I can't remember what that theme is, but I was like, oh, they're probably going to change the wallpaper, so my stuff's going to be out.
West himself spent some time in Hollywood as a screenwriter. So he's like William Faulkner, you know, being this modernist novelist who had a go at Hollywood success. In the case of West, though, it's a little tragic. He was given the job of adapting the novel that would eventually become Suspicion. But when Alfred Hitchcock was brought aboard as the director, he brought his own script with him. So West wrote an entire script for Suspicion that never got filmed. But what I think is interesting is the way he describes these sets. He's constantly describing these scenes of large military battles and of biblical epics and historical epics. And while that was the bread and butter of Hollywood in the 1930s, it's also a very specific kind of filmmaking. In the meantime, in his own head, he's the artists he's thinking about. There's a point in the book where he talks about these three artists that he is using as models for what he's doing. And he mentions Salvatore Rosa, Francesco Guardi, and Monsieur Desiderio. These are names that most people don't know at all. But all you have to know is that these were names associated with people who would paint scenes of decay, of buildings falling apart and cities falling into, in the case of Guardi, he was a Venetian artist who drew cities falling into the water. But what's really hilarious is Monsieur Desiderio is not even a real artist. Contemporary art historians realize that was a name that was ascribed to paintings that were actually done by at least three other artists. So I don't know if West knew that at the time he wrote this. I think that was a discovery that was made in the 1950s.
Oh, interesting.
At least one time a year, I have to do something that I can bring out my art history masters, because I never get.
No,
to talk
that's
about.
That's super interesting. But yeah, but I wasn't familiar with those painters, so I didn't know that. But that makes sense that he would, of course, be using people who paint destruction as inspiration for his own work.
The other thing is, these are all painters from the 18th and 17th centuries. You know, this book is written in the 1930s. America was a little slower than Europe to get into modernism, but there was modernist painting going on in America at the time. And the big names that people think of in the 1930s are people like Grant Wood or George Bellows or people like that. And what he's thinking about are these old you know, European sources that nobody cares about anymore. So he's as locked in an anachronism as these movies that he's walking through.
Well, he is Ivy League trained. Maybe he's just old and stodgy.
Well, you know us academics.
I thought I'd take a shot there for no particular reason.
Well, I mean, I guess it is too. It's obviously like the title of the work is The Day of the Locust, which obviously there's a lot of like biblical stuff there, and we obviously see them doing all these biblical epics, and maybe that's sort of where all that's coming from. Is he's looking back at all of these people who might have painted more like biblically focused things, and maybe that's why he's using that as inspiration.
No, the whole book has this strangely apocalyptic vision to it, and it does end on this horrific note of sort of the world almost ending as far as the world of this novel in this horrible riot in front of a movie theater. Although it's funny because there's this sense of impending doom throughout the book. But other than that, this book does not really have a strong narrative throughway. It's just sort of like a bunch of stuff that happens.
Yeah, there's a lot of vignettes, I guess. Like there's moments. I think the moment where I felt the sort of Hollywood satire the most was really early on when they go to that party, and you have these people who, cause that's the party for Claude Esty, right?
Right.
And so that's when he's obviously a successful screenwriter. So he's surrounded himself with lots of people who are either, that work in the industry or connected to it in some way. And I could see it there because that's when we get like the horse in the water, and we get I can't remember the character's name, but the woman who is fascinated by hearing about smut, she says constantly. And that was where I sort of got they really are jabbing at kind of Hollywood and the people who make it up. But yeah, there are just a lot of weird vignettes, and like the whole stuff with Earl and Miguel and all of that is very, very interesting.
It just felt like a lot of it for the first part was like, here's this character, here's this character, here's these characters. And this little vignette is, you know, Todd just kind of wakes up and just takes the world where he goes that day in a very bored manner. Like, someone asked me to go here, so I did. I don't like to walk. They have a car. Here, Faye might be there. And then it all just kind of like leading up, like, oh, we've introduced all these characters. Now, here's why we introduced them, because they're all going to be interacting at this one party with the cockfighting at the end. But like a lot of them had no, like Claude and Abe and Miguel had like nothing to do with each other until the very end.
The other thing that makes this book very disjointed is by the time you go through the first 10 chapters, I believe it goes into flashback like 6 or 7 times, and the timeline is completely screwed up, where we start with Todd and then Todd remembers coming to Hollywood for the first time, and then he remembers meeting Homer, and then suddenly the book takes Homer's point of view for about 3 or 4 chapters, and we follow Homer in a flashback going back to his you know, when he came to Hollywood and the first time he met Faye, and then somewhere along the line we all pop out of all these flashbacks and back to the present moment with Todd. But it's very hard to follow even who the main character is at the first part of this book.
I know they're trying to compare and contrast Homer and Todd and both how they feel about Faye. They're both in the same way, kind of just repressed about her and needing her. And like they both kind of judge each other differently about it. But it kind of swims back and forth on perspective and time. It just doesn't get a lot of momentum either way. And when they switched over to Homer, I thought, oh, are we going to get anybody else's point of view? Like, are we going to see what the world is for Faye? Like, how does she exactly see it? And then we never really do. It just kind of folds back into Todd halfway through the Homer. And like I said, it is a compare and contrast between them for most of the movie, most of the book. I almost said movie because I always do a movie podcast. But but like it's hard to really get that sense of like the movie, the book is building. We recorded before this. The book is building and building and building towards what actually is a very action-packed ending, like a very specific event, but it just kind of stops and starts all over in the middle there.
Yeah, there's a moment, I think it's towards the middle where Todd goes with Faye and Earl out to like a campsite where Miguel is staying, and they're kind of all sitting there drinking and like dancing around. And then there's this sort of scuffle where Earl seems to take offense to Miguel and they get into a fight and Faye runs off and then Todd's chasing her. And I was like, oh, OK, there's something happening here. We're getting some change in the dynamic of these characters, because at that point Todd was already sort of he was already sort of off with Earl. Like, he didn't really like Earl and he thought that he wasn't good enough for Faye. And I was like, OK, now we're getting some sort of thing. And then it's like almost as if that event never occurred. And then they are just back to being normal and hanging out together. And it was like very weird. Like, things would start to happen and you would think that it was moving in a certain direction, and then it would just sort of pull back. And maybe that's the point, is that these dynamic things happen, but then everything just sort of falls back into its sort of regular modus operandi, I guess.
Yeah, even on a smaller scale, when they had that big fight, they start and stop the fight they have at the cockfighting party like two or three times. Like, Earl and Abe almost get in a fight and then they stop and everyone's like, okay, let's just all fall back, and then it just picks back up again.
As you point out, with these fights, in some ways they're oddly consequence-free. In the sequence you were talking about earlier, just so people at home know, Earl is a cowboy from Arizona who has come to act in Westerns, but he doesn't really, like everyone else in this book, he's something of a failure. He's there as another suitor to Faye, and it's implied that he and Faye do have a sexual relationship, but Faye also has a relationship with Miguel, who is a Mexican cowboy who also appears in Westerns. And in this fight at the bonfire, Earl actually swings a club and wonks it over Miguel's head. And when you read that, you're momentarily, you're thinking, did he kill him?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I was like, oh, this is Earl's the bad guy of the story now.
It stops the scene there with the club swinging down on his head. And you think, oh, my God, this has really turned dark. And then the next time they show up, they're just back again, you know, arguing. And
it's weird. Like, and there's two scenes where Faye and Miguel have this like sexual dance where they're in a rhythm all of their own. Right. And both times their other characters come up to them and try to dance their way into it, which it's just, it's so aggressive. But like both times, just really the characters kind of walk it off. Like until Miguel is caught actually having relations with Faye, like everyone can just, like, as long as no one actually sees the completion of the act, everyone just has his, you know, repression, aggression, and then, okay, we all just did that. Let's reset.
Yeah, this is a pretty rough book as far as the characters are very mean-spirited. Poor Faye is the object of everyone's sexual desire, and usually not the willing object of most of the characters' sexual desires. Faye does get one moment where you sort of get to see a little bit into her personality, which is when she takes Todd aside and tells him that she has this plan to make a lot of money, which is she's going to give rough outlines of stories to him and he will write screenplays and they will get them made and make a million dollars, you know,
I want to read that book. I want to read them doing that, because I thought that was a great scene. I was like, oh, OK, so this is what we're setting up the movie to be. She's going to have all these crazy ideas and he's going to try to write them and they're going to try to sell them. And it's like, and then it just sort of goes away. And I was a little, I mean, I get that that's not, you know, it's obviously not what West is going for. Like, he is, again, trying to show like how everybody either tries to rise above it and then they just fall right back into their regular day to day. But yeah, I really loved that. I was like, I want to see what other ideas she has.
It's a beautiful sequence. I think it's one of the best written sequences of the book. Faye is obviously cobbling together her plot lines from the poster she has on the wall and her daydreams. And she has no idea how to end a story, but she is so guileless and so childlike in her, the way that she approaches constructing these. It's an oddly tender sequence. And Todd, while Todd is a bit dismissive of her, he indulges her in that sequence too. It's the one time in the book where I felt a little humanity coming off of the characters.
The only times like I felt like there was that scene and the scene where Homer takes her to dinner and she tries to get him drunk, and she like basically tells everybody through the book like how frustrated she is and why she's frustrated with him, that he makes her feel worse about herself, like he's judging her by trying to be better than her. It's the only times where we get to see her as described by her, as opposed to Todd's assumptions upon her about how she, her personality works and how she passes her time and how she chooses her personality. It's literally like, this is her actions telling us, as opposed to Todd's introspection of her from a side view.
Now, there's a lot of other little tangential characters. There's a dwarf bookie named Abe, who is there, I hate to say it, to just simply be gawked at, I think, in this book, in this story. It's a little unfortunate that they decided to use a little person that way.
Yeah, that's what it does seem like that. I mean, when they especially towards the end after the big fight, and they have that there's that line of them marveling sort of at how he drives a car. And
well, does this whole thing where he grabs Earl by the junk and then like is all worked up and wants to go find, you know, prostitutes. It's like, are we just supposed to laugh because this, you know, small man has these big passions?
But he's there to be foul mouthed, and we're supposed to find that hilarious. But the whole book is full of broadly drawn stereotypes and caricatures. I don't necessarily think that shows that West is out of control of the material. I think that's what he's going for here. If sophomore lit listeners remember the book Winesburg, Ohio, Sherwood Anderson talks about his characters as grotesques, and I think that in this is another story filled with these grotesques, these highly ridiculous caricatures of people. And I think, like reading or like a play by Brecht, we're supposed to not really have strong attachment to any of them. We're supposed to be a little detached from all the action in this book. Whether or not you like that, I think has to do with your stomach for this kind of broad, disgusting, gross characters.
I mean, like, I think everyone's supposed to be of some sort. Like, here's this caricature you know from Hollywood of that time. Here's a very broad version of what they would be like offset. Like Adore, the child actor, which is hard to like rectify with an actual child in real life, but where he's just does a dance, swiveling his sexual song.
Oh
his
my
hips.
Gosh, that scene! I forgot about that.
Did you know who plays him in the 1970s movie?
Who's that?
Haley Earl. What's his name?
Oh, Jackie Earl Haley.
Jackie Earl. Yeah.
Oh
as a
my
child.
God.
So look that up for a picture if you want to have some nightmares. But like, I mean, the book doesn't really out. It's not a long book, so it doesn't really ask you to spend a lot of time with these characters. Like, it knows what it's doing with them, which is nice. It just, there's at times where you just kind of just, I think you're supposed to just have your shoulders just be stooped with these characters never getting past a certain point with their own introspection.
Yeah, it's all very sort of surface level.
Yeah, we should mention this character, Adore, the child actor, who is when he's introduced, he's described as wearing a Buster Brown outfit, which is, you know, like a Little Lord Fauntleroy kind of thing. The mom has him all decked out to go be a child actor. That's already an anachronism in the 1930s. Buster Brown is from like the 1905 or so. So really creepy. Like, you picture this little creepy guy in a little suit.
That was the nostalgia at the time. We were like looking back in the late 1930s. We were looking back at Buster Brown and going, that guy had it figured out.
Yeah. When was Shirley Temple? That would have been around this time, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe a little earlier, but yeah, somewhere around here.
Doesn't the mom mention Shirley Temple and get angry about her?
I think,
like,
so.
What does she have that Adore doesn't have? But, like, I mean, there's quite a bit that she has that Adore doesn't have.
Well, she's alive. I mean, that's.
Let's talk about this sequence at the end of the book, after a lot of Faye maybe leaving, maybe not leaving. When Faye and Miguel are discovered in flagrante delicto, Homer, who Faye has been shacked up with out of convenience. Homer, by the way, we never mentioned this, but Homer is basically an accountant. We never get to see him do his work. We, to be honest, we never get to see Todd do his work either.
No.
but Homer decides he's going to go back home. Where are we? He was from Iowa, I think.
Yeah.
Well, he moved. I guess we should say, like, he moves to California because his doctor, he got sick and his doctor said, go to California to restore your health. You know, the sunshine and the fresh air, it'll do you some good. But he was an accountant at a hotel in Iowa, and he sort of almost had a sexual encounter with a person who lived there, and it was very sort of traumatic for him, I think, and that's sort of why he is the way that he is now.
Apparently he made enough as an accountant for a hotel in Iowa to live, buy a house in California and never go to work, and buy an aspiring actress everything she wants for what seems to be several months. But he doesn't eat a lot, though, so that's, he just eats anchovies and crackers.
So this final sequence of the novel takes place at a movie premiere in front of the
Pleasure Dome.
The Pleasure Dome, which is another literary reference here. This is a reference to Coleridge's Kubla Khan. If you're like me and you can't help but be drawn to these references, I just don't know what West is on about there, because Coleridge's Kubla Khan is a notoriously confusing poem. It was based upon probably a drug hallucination. So
well, I mean, the whole ending of this book almost feels like, so, like, Faye is gone out of the book, and without Faye, like, Todd's kind of detached and unanchored for his whole entire life. Like, it almost could have just happened in his head.
Yeah, well, there are those moments, like, where when the riot is going and Todd is sort of being swept up in it, and he's trying to sort of extract himself from it and think about his painting. And I was wondering, like, is Todd painting this riot and he's imagining it in his head and he's imagining getting caught in it? Or is it the other way around, where he actually is in the riot and he's imagining using this as inspiration for his painting? And there were moments where it seemed like it was blending into one thing. And I still don't know exactly what, like, if it went that way or not, or if it's just sort of him trying to center himself so he doesn't get completely crushed.
I mean, in this whole thing where is the first time he honestly tries to help out Homer. Like, they've been friends by vicinity for the whole book, even though Homer would like it to be more, it feels like. But like when Homer's having his breakdown here, like it's the first time that Faye's not involved and he's like, oh, I'll help him. And he can't. Like, he's ineffectual at everything he does in this entire scene. Like, he's just like, he's been swept up the whole book, but it's been through just like, I'm near Faye and whatever Faye does, I'm swept up with. Now he's just swept. He's completely swept away. He's completely has no power over anything anymore. It just feels surreal at that point.
Randomly in the midst of this riotous crowd, Homer has just showed up on his way to get out of town. Todd is there. There's not really a strong motivation for everyone being in the same place, but they're all being crushed by the crowd. And then a door shows up trying to play practical jokes.
Where does he have the room to do this in the middle of the room? Like, where does he have the space to pull this prank?
Somehow he has the space to pull this elaborate cartoonish prank of trying to bait Homer with a purse of money.
Yeah, on a string, like, go for it, old man, and I'll trick you.
Like, every now and then a book will do something like this where, like, it just totally shatters my sense of space and time and frame of reference. I'm like, no, like, there's some of this tree and everything. Where's this tree in downtown Los Angeles?
Well, it ends up with a door throwing a rock at Homer, and then yep. Homer basically curb stomps the door.
Curb stomps him, he splatters him.
Yeah. Again, we're not explicitly told that he's killed Adore, but he has jumped
like
a small
it.
Child three times or more.
Yeah, and this causes the crowd to sort of turn on Homer and basically then sends everyone into this like frenzied panic.
Except for when they stop and have little chats about it every now and then. They have very calm chats in the middle of it, and Todd might have broken his leg.
The thing about Homer's assault on Adore is it's such a violent sequence and so weird that I was trying to figure out some sort of an allegorical meaning to this, but I couldn't come up with anything other than it's just the characters of this book destroying each other. You know, we've reached the end of the book and everything is falling apart and the characters are turning one on each other and this whole world is collapsing.
I mean, he's been repressed the whole book, but it hasn't been about child violence. Like, it's not like it's not the release that you're expecting him to have built towards.
But it's ironic that he uses his feet and not his enormous hands.
not his giant hands. He could just put one hand on Adore and he would crush him.
Here's the thing. He is now his hands. His hands are all of him now. That's my deep insight into the book. At the end of the book, Homer is no more. Homer's hands are all of Homer.
We end with Todd being carted away by the police, not being taken to jail, but being sort of taken into protective custody. And with the sirens, it's one of those kinds of shocking endings where you're left to there's no clear direction for anyone. You know, nothing seems redeemable at the end of this book. And how did it make you feel?
Josh,
I think it's interesting the way that it does end, because it ends with him hearing the siren and it making him laugh, and he can't tell if the laughter is the noise is the siren or if it's his laughter. And that kind of mirrors a lot of other sort of weird examples of laughter that we get throughout the book, like Faye's father, Harry. He kind of laughs to bug Faye almost. And then during like the cockfight sequence, we have some weird descriptions of the way that Abe is laughing, like in a very sort of stilted, weird way. And it was interesting to see like Todd, like maybe in that moment, Todd is because I think throughout the majority of the book, he sort of situates himself like above all of these people, as if he is better than them because he is this great painter who's going to create this masterpiece, and he needs to study all of these people to fully populate this painting and have like the very have very realistic situations. And I think at this point, like at the end, when he's laughing, he can't sort of understand whether it's his voice or the siren that he's hearing. It's like he's finally a part of that world that he tried to keep himself above for the most part. So I found that really interesting. But I also found it like, well, our main character's lost his mind. So,
yeah, like it felt, I mean, the whole book seems disconnected in its from the characters in a way. And just like the whole ending is just kind of this weird, violent, but stilted dreamscape of violence. And it's just off putting where you read it and you end and you're like, huh, that was something. And like what is the book railing against? You kind of think about it for a second, like, well, it's railing against Hollywood types and the fakeness, but like just the violence against the rich from the lower class. Cause that, they kind of mentioned that, but they don't really go that far. And it just kind of sat on me for like a good hour of just like, not exactly, there's no pinpoint on it. And that's interesting in its own way. It's not razor focused at the end on what you like, here's what I meant. It's just poof, explosion at the end. All the characters are kind of messed. There you go. That's life.
This book feels like a puzzle to me because there are so many clues that you're supposed to be taking things symbolically or allegorically, that there's some sort of a thematic key to this book. And that has to do with the number of literary allusions throughout this book and the number of allusions to specific artists. And the way in which we have each character sort of defined by these strange moments, like the long segment where we're talked about how Homer has a lizard that lives in a tree or a bush. And he likes to watch the lizard and the likes to watch the flies. And he sees life as a struggle, but he never wants to interject himself into that struggle.
Well, he's a victim and the fly's a victim and he doesn't ever step out of being a victim.
But the book doesn't provide any answers, any way out for anyone, or any vision of what
they could have done.
Yeah, or what like an authentic life would be. You know, if Hollywood is a weird dreamscape, Todd's academic detachment is not a good alternative, and Homer's down-to-earth, man-of-the-people approach is not a good one either. No one has the answers to what a good life would be in this book.
Right. Even the people, they say even the people who came there with, you know, not so much dreams, just go to California because it's pretty and the Hollywood people are there and they're working normal jobs. Even they're bored. Even they're restless. They've seen it all. What does it mean? What does it bring to them? I got to say, though, as far as like a movie that is written by a guy who did screenplays and screenwriting back then, that's, you would think, is very hyper specifically towards the 1930s. It doesn't really feel like out of place reading it today, which is nice. Like, you don't feel like you've missed any of the super specific references to what was going on in movies at that time.
Yeah. And I really feel like this is such a model for so many Hollywood stories I've seen after this. I was just thinking as I was preparing this that a lot of this reminds me of Repo Man, in that it's another story that takes place in LA where we have all these outsiders coming together in this complex but picaresque plot that sort of abruptly ends.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
So many stories about Hollywood are about this idea of the betrayal of dreams or of people thinking that they're going to be a part of something that they're not. This book touches on marginalized people. There's a sequence where Faye takes Homer to a a drag show, and she doesn't have a high opinion of the drag queens. And in fact, there's a lot of invective against homosexuality in this section, but it's not, I don't think that from the standpoint of the narrative voice, we're supposed to partake in that. This is about as open as you get in the 1930s about this sort of stuff. And in some ways, I'm kind of shocked that this book came out in 39.
I actually was, too. That was a weird thing for me, because I kept thinking that for some reason that this came out in like the mid 50s, because as Brian mentioned, like it doesn't feel dated in the language that it uses and how it's written. Like it feels very contemporary. Like, I mean, there might be a few like turns of phrase here and there that are a little different from what we're used to, but there was never a point where I was like confused by the language that was being used. And yeah, some of the things that they talk about, I was like, this was written and came out in 1939. Like it feels like a 50s or 60s book to me.
Failure never changes.
Now, we've mentioned this movie. Have either of you seen the movie?
I have not. I need to. I have a coworker. Not. Yeah.
Go on, Josh.
I have a coworker who's seen it, and I think he said he liked it, but it was a while ago, so he doesn't remember much about it.
I have not seen it, but when I look at the cast, it seems like the most incredibly 1970s cast you could imagine.
Yeah, like Karen Black is Faye. Homer is
Donald Sutherland.
Todd Hackett's not fat, which is the first thing I noticed. Like, oh, they didn't cast a chubbier guy as him. That's not surprising.
Yeah, William Atherton, man.
When Karen Black did this film, though, she was probably in her early 30s. So that may kind of take away some of the sting of
Faye's age. Now, the book didn't become popular too much later after it came out, right? Because it wasn't a lot of West stuff.
West is a guy who certainly got his fame grew after his death. He did get some notoriety in his day, but he's, I think people are drawn to him because they see in this book and also in Miss Lonely Hearts, which takes place in the newsroom of a metropolitan newspaper in the 30s. They see this as these really interesting windows into these worlds. I don't know, as I read this through, how realistic this depiction is. From what I gather, West had a tangential relationship with the movie studios that he was in. He was hired as a writer. He wrote, and I don't know that he actually got any of his stuff produced. So to the extent that he actually was a, this is an accurate depiction of Hollywood in the 1930s, I can't say.
Like I said, it's not even about being, you know, Hollywood in the long run. It's just like people on the margins who not only aren't successful, but maybe just don't have a chance to ever be successful, because try as hard as these characters might, as far as like their will and their just stubbornness, they all have something missing from doing what they want to be able to do. And that isn't always just a thing with Hollywood.
Yeah. That sounds about right to me.
Like, you can bang your head against the wall, but sometimes it isn't going to happen for you. And the longer you do it, the worse it gets.
So
this you can have a podcast that goes on for years about Crazy Town. Nobody that will ever care. Not even the band themselves will ever mention it.
Josh was asking me earlier if this is a book that gets taught in the high schools at all. It gets taught in some high schools. It gets taught a lot in colleges. And as I've said before, the subject matter of this podcast is flexible. It's sort of generally about formative books that people read when they're young, and young could mean between the time of 10 and 25. But now that you've read this, what do you think? Would this be a book you would be you would have been happy to have read in high school?
Maybe. I mean, I was actually thinking back to kind of that time in my life. As I mentioned earlier, like, I grew up in Mississippi, so, you know, different states have different sort of curriculums and things that they teach. And we did kind of the bigger ones that you might expect. So like Lord of the Flies and Animal Farm were ones that got assigned in like 9th and 10th grade. And I'm trying to think of some of the others, but I don't know if this feels, I don't know if it feels too adult or if it feels too surreal. I mean, not that like Animal Farm is not surreal in its own way, or that Lord of the Flies is not surreal in its own way. But like, I don't know, because it's not, I guess it's not presenting it as this fantastical scenario. It's just these people who are in kind of these positions that are just on the edges of where they really want to be. And so the surrealism like comes, I guess, more slowly than in some of those other books that I read. But I don't know. I don't know if it's like the mentions of prostitution or those kinds of things, if that would have been too adult for us, or if it would have been something that our teachers could have gotten anything from. I'm interested to see if there are like what the lesson plans might look like for a sophomore lit class where this is an assigned reading.
Oh God, growing up in Canada, if I read this, I would have thought, well, it's a weird American book. I can't, it has nothing to do with what I live here in the Maritimes. I think I would have enjoyed it more in college, as far as like, you know, in college, you're going through that kind of just dream state of like detachment of going class to class. Everything kind of is scheduled for you. And in between, you just kind of float to where your friends are at and just experience things as it comes. And I think that this would have had more of a pull to that, like everyone trying to make it. And you kind of look at other people like, nah, they won't, but I'll probably make it, but they won't. And I think that would have grabbed me more in a college setting. But in high school, I would have been like, it's too dreamlike. I just don't. I'm too far removed from West Coast America, 1930s and 1990s Nova Scotia, to really grab onto it in any particular way.
Yeah, I think if I had read it in college, it definitely would have grabbed me more, because that was around the era where I started. I think this is where a lot of people do it, but they get really into movies. And so you start just watching everything. You're watching tons of old like black and white silent films, and you're watching things from the 40s, and you're watching, you know, international cinema for like really the first time, and really like engaging with all of these different types of films. And I feel like if this book had come across, or even the movie even had come across my lap in that era, like I think it would have clicked with me like really, really well.
Yeah, I also think that in college, if you are a reader, and to be honest, mostly if you are if you're a young white male reader, that's when you're most prone to novels that have a sort of a bleak nihilism about them. This is This is the time when everyone reads A Clockwork Orange and loves it, for example. I read a lot of these kinds of novels, especially these mid-century novels that were like that, that were very bleak and nothing's, and everyone's sort of trapped by their situation in life. They're very naturalistic that way. Now I have less patience for that, which is funny, because the typically I find the opposite to be true, which is I find that when you're a teenager, that's when you really look at these books and you say, oh, this person is making bad decisions. I'm not interested in this character because he's stupid. Now it's not that I mind people making bad decisions. It's just I feel too much of West's bleak cynicism about everything, and I just hope he had a happier life than what this book might suggest.
I can see that, just looking at him like, oh, that's, if you read too much of West into this as far as some of the characters, which I read people say, like, hey, don't read too much of West into this. He's more like the other books. But it's still, to be able to present this much cynicism, you got to have it in you, because like it is from beginning to end, nothing but. So if you don't have that in your heart, it's hard to really capture it this succinctly.
Well, that's a very cheerful note to end on here.
Any? Way to go, Brian.
This is what I do. I make other people miserable.
Thanks to my co-hosts, Josh Hollis and Brian Skinner. Their podcast, PredictedCast, is available wherever you download podcasts. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write to the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. You can join in on the Facebook page, or you can look for us on The Incomparable membership Slack. I don't know what we're reading next time, but whatever it is, keep it up, because everything is going to be on the final.